for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stephen Cohen's firm, SAC Capital Advisors, is one of the top-performing hedge funds in the world, and it made him one of the 50 wealthiest people in the United States. But this past November, SAC Capital agreed to plead guilty to charges of insider trading and pay a record of $1.2 billion fine. Although other hedge fund managers like Raj Rajaratnam have been successfully prosecuted, Stephen Cohen hasn't been charged with any crime, even though Reuters has reported he personally signed off on the trades being investigated. In a new report called To Catch a Trader, PBS Frontline correspondent Martin Smith looks at hedge funds and how the government has cracked down on insider trading. It airs tonight on PBS, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Martin Smith back to our show.
It's good to be back.
SAC Capital pled guilty as a firm. In the current New York Review of Books, Judge Jed Rakoff observes that in recent decades, prosecutors have been increasingly attracted to prosecuting companies, often without indicting a single person. With your reporting on the financial crisis and now insider trading, why do you think prosecutors are doing that?
Well, that's a good question. Have these non-prosecution agreements, deferred prosecution agreements, charging companies and avoiding charging people. It's gotten a lot of controversial, a lot of debate. We broadcast a program called The Untouchables. The Untouchables referring to bankers who were not being held accountable for the mortgage debacle.
And you were
of 2008.
On the show to talk about that.
And I came here and we spoke about that. After that program, in which the head of the criminal division, Lanny Brewer, had stated that that he tried hard but couldn't hold people individually responsible, he was called on the carpet, and his boss was called to Capitol Hill to testify on this very issue. That was a bit more complicated because there they said that these companies were too big to fail, that if you indict these companies, you can cause all sorts of collateral damage and all sorts of consequences. But in this case, with SAC Capital being simply a hedge fund, a large one, they chose to indict it rather than the principal.
Well, one of the differences with the banks and the hedge funds is that the victims in the subprime mortgage crisis were poor people lured into mortgages they couldn't afford. The victims of insider trading of hedge funds are very wealthy people.
Not always.
Well, not everyone can even get into hedge funds.
But your pension fund may be invested in a hedge fund. It's not unusual for large pension funds to place some of their money in a hedge fund. So you're exposed.
Well, it was my reason, the reason I was giving myself for the fact that they are going after hedge fund managers in a way that they didn't go after bankers. In December, SAC Capital portfolio manager Michael Steinberg was found guilty of insider trading. Has he been sentenced yet?
No. His sentencing is not until March or April, I believe.
Is he likely to serve time, or is he, as they say, too big to jail?
No, he will serve time. If you remember, Raj Rajaratnam, the head of Galleon Fund, was sentenced to 11 years. There have been a number of people in this, what's called Operation Perfect Hedge, a seven-year investigation by the FBI. There have been a number of people who have been convicted and are serving time, and many more who have pled guilty.
The FBI raided SAC Capital Advisors in November 2010. How long has the government been investigating inside dealing?
Well, you know, this all came about, interestingly, because initially the FBI was investigating these pump-and-dump schemers. These are low-level guys that take a thinly traded stock and they pump up the through rumors and whatnot and postings the value of it, or they drive it down and then they make money that way. And
that's these the guys, subject of Martin Scorsese's film, The Wolf of Wall Street.
And I haven't seen it yet, but I will. The issue there was that these guys said to the FBI, says, why are you picking on us? We're small fry. Why don't you go after the big guys at the hedge funds on Wall Street or in Connecticut? And so they started to turn their attention to that and realize that there was a lot more corruption at much higher levels than they had suspected.
Well, 60 Minutes reported on allegations against SAC in 2006. And the business reporter Charles Gasparino says that SAC Capital had a reputation for insider trading. Were people just speculating about that, or did SAC cover its tracks very well, or was the government not interested until it was forced to be?
I think the government wasn't really paying attention to it. They also had a bias that, as you said, some of these investors in these big hedge funds are sophisticated, and so they just let it be. But beginning in 05, 06, after they were sort of pointed in this direction by these pump-and-dump schemers, they started to investigate. Their first big target was Galleon, the Rajarajaratnam hedge fund. But from that fallout, a number of people pled guilty, and some of those people pointed to SAC Capital. These guys, these portfolio managers, change companies. They change they change funds quite often. So there was a lot of movement back and forth, and a couple of them said, look, you ought to be looking at Stephen Cohen.
Isn't SAC Capital still in business?
SAC Capital is still in business, but they're winding down. They made an agreement with the U.S. attorney that they would have to shut down, but they're given some time to do that, and they have to come to terms with the judge. But they've agreed to pay, as you said, a $1.2 billion fine in addition to the fine, the $600,000 fine they had to pay to the SEC. So they're winding down, and what will happen is that most likely it will cease to exist as a fund that takes outside money and will become what's called a family office. And at the end of the day, unless he's convicted and does jail time, Stephen Cohen will manage his money without outside money involved. So he'll have $6 or $7 billion to invest as a family office.
So this could be seen as just the price of doing business.
You could look at it that way.
I mean, I wouldn't mind having to pay $1.2 billion if I then was left with $6 billion.
Yeah, I think that's the way most people look at this.
And Michael Milken was convicted on securities and reporting violations, sentenced to 10 years, fined $600 million, was reduced to 2 years. Today he's worth $2 billion.
Well, the question here, though, is Steve Cohen guilty of committing crimes? He's not been charged with a crime. His company was charged as a criminal enterprise, and seven of the former traders at SAC Capital have either pled guilty or been tried and are, in the case of Steinberg, awaiting sentencing. Was Cohen guilty is the question. Was he simply willfully blind? Did he simply set up a system with incentives that created the atmosphere in which people wanted and were willing to cheat? Did he know about it? And we're going to find out more with the trial that's starting this morning, with jury selection this morning in the case of Matthew Martoma.
Sheila Kolhatkar of Bloomberg Business Week has written that SAC was structured like a bicycle wheel with Stephen Cohen at the center. Well, if he was the hub, that would suggest that he must have known what was going on.
Well, you know, as I was saying, as I was posing the question as to whether he's guilty or not, I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who are guffawing because it seems incredible that you could structure this company, set it up, have so many convictions, have the whole company itself be convicted, and he not really know about it. But in a lot of businesses in America, if you run an operation and things go horribly wrong, you can be held liable for criminal negligence, even if you didn't participate in the actual crime, if you were just negligent in the way you managed it. In finance, that's not the case. He has been charged civilly by the Securities and Exchange Commission for what's called failure to supervise, but there's no criminal corollary to failing to supervise in finance.
I wish I'd had a couple of bosses who had failed to supervise. Martin Smith is my guest. His investigative report, To Catch a Trader, will be broadcast tonight on PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. You mentioned the fact that one of the SAC's portfolio managers, Matthew Martoma, is on trial. It began yesterday. Since Steinberg was found guilty and others are pleading guilty, what does Martoma think his chances of acquittal are?
Well, I haven't spoken to Matthew Martoma. Obviously, he believes that the best, the wisest path for him is to go to trial. But that and I question that. I believe he's probably going to lose. But he's made the decision that he's better off fighting this. Cohen himself is paying for his legal expenses. But he could face 10 to 20 years in prison for the size of his – the sentencing is based on the size of the insider trading profits. And in this case, they had loaded up on a lot of these stocks, Elon and Wyeth, that were involved in these drug trials with an Alzheimer's drug. And then they learned very close to the trial results being released that it wasn't going so well. So they started to dump it. And they dumped and the combined between what they got rid of, the risk they got rid of, and the shorting of the stocks, they it was worth $276 million.
And they got inside information in a process that is that could easily be legal, but really does tempt people.
Well, I don't think if they, in fact, got the information from the doctor or the two doctors that are going to be testifying at the trial and traded based on that information, that was so-called material non-public information, and that would be illegal.
That's would the doctors what the government also be alleged. Liable?
The doctors made some money, but they've pled. So, yes, they're liable, but they've pled, and so they're trying to get a good deal for themselves. But what Cohen or Martoma is saying is that it wasn't based on that information. They based it on other information that wasn't non-public information.
Hey, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara seems to have been more aggressive in these insider trading cases. Do you think it's because he saw what happened with the banking crisis, or just simply is he working in a different climate?
Well, you have to remember that he began these investigations before the blow-up of 2008. So a lot of the resources of his office were going into these insider trading investigations while all these fraudulent mortgages were being sold. And he faces some criticism from various quarters about where he allocated his resources and whether he was paying attention to the biggest crime on Wall Street or whether the whether he missed the boat. He has made this his signature effort.
And he's done rather well. He's gotten 78 convictions so far, although I'm not sure how many people have actually gone to prison.
Well, some of those are many of those. Most of those are people pleading guilty because they saw that they would get a better outcome if they pled and cooperated. And many of them then either wore a wire or informed on fellow traders. Some of the people – it's a very tawdry affair because people were informing and ratting on their best friends, and this rolled out. And some people have gone to trial and some people have gone to jail.
Michael Steinberg fainted minutes after the jury entered the courtroom to deliver its verdict. He was guilty. Matthew Martoma fainted when authorities confronted him. A lot of fainting going on. Was it such a shock to be prosecuted? Did they think that they were bound to get away with this?
You know, I guess that when it happens, it causes fainting spells, I guess, when the FBI shows up.
More fainting here than in 19th century novels.
Yeah, there's a lot of fainting.
Martin Smith is with us. He is the investigative reporter who covered the story that is being broadcast tonight as part of the PBS Frontline series called To Catch a Trader. And we, T-R-A-D-E-R. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Martin Smith, who is the investigative reporter for PBS's Frontline show To Catch a Trader, which will be airing tonight on PBS, what, at 9 o'clock?
It's 10 o'clock. Check your local listings, I have to say, because it gets switched around in various places. But 10 o'clock now.
And 10 o'clock because this is adult material?
There are a few four-letter words thrown around in the midst of it, but I think most people can handle it.
Regarding the case of Raj Rajaratnam and the Galleon Group, FBI agent David Chaves describes approaching some traders like detectives in Law and Order, and they were like scenes out of crime dramas with all these people fainting.
Yeah, no, they would do these arrests where they would study somebody's sort of habits and where they would go and at what time they left their home and when they would go on breaks. And they would go to Starbucks, for instance, and get behind them in line. And just before they were about to order their coffee, they'd say, I take it with a little milk and one tablespoon of sugar. And, you know, then they'd make the arrest. They'd shock the
The person they were, the suspect, because they knew so much about him.
That's right.
At least they knew about his coffee tastes.
Yes.
Well, and then the whole thing has a kind of a tone of Hollywood movies. Attorney Duff, formerly of the Galleon Group, describes a high-flying social life as a trader, and the hedge fund manager Danielle Chiesi is on tape saying, "Hey, baby," to Raj Rajaratnam, and then saying that she's a chick in this business. They sound like somebody's writing their scripts for them.
I'm a chick in this business, yeah. Who knows a lot about IBM, I think, as she said. And she was, in fact, having an affair at the time with the head of with one of the officials at IBM.
The FBI tapped the phones of Galleon traders, including Rajaratnam. That's the first time they had ever directly monitored calls in an insider trading case. Why was it never done before, especially since so much of the inside communication happened over telephones?
You know, it was just a sort of a gentleman's agreement that you don't go there.
Well, they don't seem – the NSA doesn't seem to have that agreement with other people.
And the NSA runs by a different playbook, I guess. But they had not done this. They had done consensual wires. That's where I wear a wire as I've turned informer and I go to you, Leonard, and I get you to confess to something we did together. But they had never done phones, texts, emails. And that really changed the whole game because now they're treating these guys like mobsters and they're collecting – hours upon hours of material and are able to go in and get a whole raft of information.
And then the thing goes to trial. Is a trial a way of entering into a negotiation, especially since sentencing is separate from whether somebody is found guilty or not?
I'm sorry. I didn't quite get your question.
It seems to me that we have the trials being used as negotiating tools. Even before sentencing, you can say to somebody, give us some more names.
I think what mostly they're doing that before the trials, as I understand it, before they say to somebody, you can go to jail for 20 years or you can talk to us and tell us what you know. That's where they're getting most of the cooperation.
Now, Stephen Cohn has been a major art collector. Recently, he sold off work by some pretty top artists, Cy Twombly, Andy Warhol, Gerhard Richter. Would that suggest that he may be raising money for legal defense, that he suspects that he's going to be prosecuted?
Well, we investigated a lot of things, but I didn't look at his last 10 years of art sales, and I assume that he buys as well. He sells and buys, and who knows, perhaps he needed a little extra holiday money, or he needs money to help pay for some of his legal costs. I can't really say, but we tried to attend the auction at Sotheby's were not permitted.
Now, Wall Street Journal reporter Jenny Strasberg says that the Journal knew their November 2010 report breaking news of the a nationwide federal investigation would be a game changer. Was it?
Yeah. No, that was when the whole business of SAC Capital sort of broke. We'd heard a lot about the Raj Rajaratnam and the Galleon case. But when Strasberg's piece came out in November of 2010, that's when it was clear that the government was going after SAC.
Well, at the time, there were also reports that Goldman Sachs bankers were under investigation and that federal authorities were preparing charges against others across the United States. But those charges were never brought.
We didn't. I don't know what happened with that.
Maybe they felt they couldn't make the case, although Goldman Sachs really does look culpable in a number of stories that I've heard.
Well, they have to go with what they've got, what tape recordings they have. You know, they haven't been able to charge Cohen himself with any crimes. They did put a wire on him at one point. and then had to take it down when they couldn't produce results. So it's not as if they can just put a wire on anybody and keep it there until they trip up. They have to make a good argument before a judge. The judge then gives them the permission, and then they have to produce results within a reasonable amount of time, within a month or so, or they have to take it down.
Duff and others talk about getting edge information that could guide trading. How was their information any better than information a regular trader or a journalist or a member of the public might get?
Well, if it's insider information, if it falls under the definition of material non-public information, that's like 100% edge.
Well, can you describe what a first call is?
A first call is something different. Now, a first call is something that a hedge fund manager gets if he's a particularly good client of his brokerage house. The brokerage house places the trades for a commission. And if you're a particularly good active trader, you're very attractive to that brokerage house. And so they give you a little bit more information than they would give to you, Leonard, or me, calling up and making our little bitty trades. So you get what's called the first call. Cohen paid very high commissions. He could have paid a lot less. He could have negotiated. Certainly with the volume of trading he was doing at SAC Capital, he could have done less. But he was willing to pay more so he would get these first calls. Now, that was—
So that gave him the edge.
That gave him a kind of edge. But those first calls weren't—you know, the question is, what was in those first calls? Was that material non-public information? Was it just a little bit of a, you know, more rumor material to sort of— And all these guys will say is, look, we get a lot of information. It's kind of a mosaic. We don't make it based on one piece of hot information. And that's one way they say that, you know, we're not really trading on specific insider info, but we're kind of putting together a mosaic. We're doing our homework.
Well, part of that mosaic is expert networks, another source of information for traders. What are expert networks?
Yeah, well, to be clear, too, about the mosaic, you don't need a mosaic of information if you've got a hot inside piece of information. You just need that piece of information. If you know that something is going to be upgraded or downgraded within 20 minutes from now, you can buy or sell accordingly and make a lot of money. You don't need any other research. The expert networks are a very important player in all of this. These are most of them doing legitimate work, helping brokers or portfolio managers make decisions about what to buy or sell. They're providing research. But they charge a good bit of money to put you – say you're a portfolio manager and you want to get a little bit of information. You go to one of these expert networks and you say, do you have anybody in the technology space who really knows what's happening at Dell Computer or at NVIDIA, the chip, you know, or Intel? And they may put you in touch with somebody who works inside one of those companies. Now, that person's not supposed to divulge information. But once you're put in the room with them, it's kind of like an escort service. You don't really – nobody's monitoring whether you had sex or not.
And there's a blurry line.
There's a very blurry line. But if that person – if that expert network puts you in touch with somebody, gets you on the phone with somebody – that is inside a company and has inside non-public information that's material, meaning that it will affect the performance of a stock, that then is clearly against the law. That's clearly over the line.
Well, James Fleischman, former vice president at an expert network firm called Primary Global Research, admitted that experts might discuss things that they legally should not. Did he or any other managers at PGR or other firms do anything to prevent those kinds of disclosures?
Well, they protected themselves, for one, by making these link-ups, but then not monitoring carefully what was going on in the room, if you will. Once these portfolio managers were in touch with the experts that they put them in touch with. So they didn't – the compliance or the monitoring of those contacts was not all it could have been, according to James Fleischman himself. That's what he told us. James Fleischman was arrested and served time for his role at an expert network in making these link-ups.
Martin Smith is the is a frontline correspondent, and he's taken a look at hedge funds and how the government has cracked down on insider trading in a show called To Catch a Trader that will be airing tonight at 10 locally here on Channel 13. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A huge subject for economists is asymmetric information, the edge. Economists Joseph Stiglitz, Michael Spence, George Akerlof, whose wife, Janet Yellen, was just confirmed to be the next head of the Federal Reserve, won the Nobel Prize for work that they did 30 years ago on the economics of asymmetric information. Don't we know enough about information asymmetrics or asymmetries, the edge insider trading, to regulate it adequately now?
Well, it's a fire hose of information that you've got to somehow collect and make sense of. And I think the government is getting better with sophisticated computer programs that allow them to make correlations between trading, phone calls, texts, emails. They're catching up. They're playing a catch-up game. But yes, we know enough about regulating this, and the SEC, which has been asleep at the wheel for some time. I mean, the Madoff affair was clearly the nadir. Is trying to catch up.
Well, hedge funds are meant to hedge their bets.
They used to be.
Yeah, that's no longer what they do?
Well, they became sort of – the name stuck, but the role of the funds themselves changed quite a bit. It used to be that if you had all your money sort of leaning over in this direction – a lot of it was in, say, precious metals or whatever. You might go to a hedge fund in order to hedge that bet, to protect yourself in case the precious metals market collapsed. But as time went on, they just became sort of they evolved into these playpens for hot money managers, where you, if you had enough money, say $5 million, where a sophisticated investor could put your money, or if you were a big hedge fund, you could put your money in. I'm sorry, if you're a big pension fund, you could put your money in there, and you'd get the benefit of a real hot money manager's returns.
Since they're not sold to the general public, is that why they've been historically exempt from any regulations?
Well, I think that people sort of gave them a pass. They figure if sophisticated investors are in that sandbox and they get, hurt, they knew what they were getting into. But the Fidelity now is going to offer a fund, I think, that invests in a hedge fund. And it's they're going to figure out, I think they are figuring out how to make this a product that can be sold to you and me.
Well, they really started to take off in the late 1990s when Bill Clinton was the president. We were seeing a lot of deregulation. Long-term capital management was one of the early very successful hedge funds, but then it failed in 1998, was bailed out by Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve. Was that an early example of too big to fail?
Absolutely. That was a too big to, that was, exhibit number one in too big to fail.
Now, at points in the documentary, you sound incredulous. You say, you ask, how in the hell can that be legal? Was there something that you thought should be illegal?
Well, it's not for me to prescribe what's illegal or illegal, but I think I reflect what a lot of people would, how people would react to that. I mean, this was about these first calls. I was speaking with a fellow, and he was explaining that some of that is until some tightening at the SEC more recently, that was some of those first calls were considered legal, that you could kind of run up a big bill at a brokerage house and be privy to information that the rest of us were not privy to.
Until 2012, Congress allowed its own members to engage in insider trading. It ended that exemption from the law with the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. But if Congress could benefit from it, what incentive did it have to act against insider trading on Wall Street?
Well, it's not.
And then you have libertarians saying this shouldn't be a crime anyway.
Yeah, well, there's people that argue it's a victimless crime. I disagree with that. I think everybody would like to be reassured that the markets are at least relatively fair. and that the playing field is relatively level. If we do nothing to ensure that, if we do nothing to regulate that, now, then what are we doing? We have to admit to ourselves that it can't be perfectly level. There's always going to be people that are able to deduce and come up with more research than the next guy, or that certainly than you or me, and do very well by it. But if we take hands off of it entirely, you're just ensuring that the whole thing runs like a rigged casino.
Well, I'm always curious about why certain people wind up being penalized and not others. Martha Stewart for a relatively small sum in insider trading, Raj Rajaratnam, but not a lot of other people. Do we pick and choose? Is it the people we have the strongest cases against, or the people who the public will be most likely to want to see prosecuted?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and say there are no politics involved whatsoever. But I think by and large, it's a matter of what evidence that the investigators have. I mean, nobody wants to go to court and lose. So even if you suspect that Stephen Cohen is guilty, until you have the evidence to show that he, in fact, committed a crime, there's no reason to go to court.
And the government has lost a few cases along the way.
Not in insider trading since this whole Operation Perfect Hedge, as the FBI calls it, began. They have not lost any cases.
Martin Smith's report, To Catch a Trader, will be broadcast tonight at 10 o'clock locally on Channel 13, but on PBS stations all across the country. It's always a pleasure to have you on our show.
Leonard, it's a pleasure to be here.